Thanks, Philip. Thanks very much. And I'm hearing a lot of messages in between the lines as well as on the lines in that kind of picture there. And I think quite challenging for perhaps the world that we live in just now. We learn things every day, and I would just like to share this because I think it's important that I am kind of get this out because I'm feeling like a real idiot. I went into a shop and got a cup of coffee and a scone, and the guy gave me a bit of butter and I put it in my pocket. And I'd like to share that butter with you here. So I've learned something today, and I hope you've learned something, that's not as stupid as I've learned, anyway. But it's in there, and all the coins are all covered in butter and things like that. So, good, I feel better now. Thanks for that, for being there for me. Our next contributor, I could wax on a fair wee bit, but rare in the world of formal education and state education is somebody who has actually done what they talk about. I have worked with educators, directors, assistant directors, head teachers, teachers, everybody in the school system. I've sat in groups with them all over the world, and most of them bull me about what they think should happen, not having ever done it. Don Ledingham has done it all. Anything Don talks about in the next 15 minutes, he has direct experience of it. I've seen Don do ballet classes. I've seen Don play rugby. He was better at the ballet, I have to say. He would play rugby in one pitch, I was playing football on the other one in Gala Shields. He stayed thin, I didn't, and that's part and parcel of the food problem, but that's another story. Don then moved on from being a class teacher to being a school leader. He was a deputy leader, a head teacher in a number of situations and a number of places, and led what could only be called unique initiatives in schools. He then became head of education in a local authority. Uniquely in Scotland, he became a head of education for two local authorities at the same time. Nobody does that. However, he saw the light and came back from the dark side, as I call it, and then moved on, and he's now working with Drummond International, about to work internationally, looking at leadership and learning and education and in other contexts across the world. And I think he deserves it. He's also from the borders, as I am, and it's a beautiful place, as I heard last night from our colleague there. So I think we're going to hear some interesting inputs. Don Ledingham, nice to see you.
Thanks, Rory. I'm going to start off with a wee story about the best lesson I ever taught. And then from that, I want to maybe extrapolate some lessons about leadership and then reflect upon the leadership process, perhaps how it relates to happiness, and then finish with a very recent experience in Shetland, which has been very uplifting for me. So the best lesson I taught was a dance lesson. It was a dance lesson with 30 youngsters, half of whom were boys, and it was probably the most emotional experience I've ever had in a classroom. It was the culmination of 3 years' work. I came back from a secondment, having been lecturing at university, came back to school with a view in the borders to say, is it possible to change the culture of a school? Is it possible to take something which is completely alien to people and actually translate it into practice? And I wanted to explore the notion of creative dance. And it's a hard shift in the borders where, you know, if you're not a rugby player, rugby players are associated with a particular type of manliness, type of behaviour, and the notion of boys dancing just isn't part of the formula. So 3 years later, we had a dance group where the youngsters had a chance to volunteer between taking a tennis class or a dance class. And all of the boys chose to do dance. Four of those boys played rugby for Scottish schools. Two of them went on to play rugby for Scotland. So we're talking about macho guys. They chose a piece of music from Tosca, E Luce Vane Stella. They created a dance amongst boys and girls of a funeral scene that, when I think back to it, raises the hairs on my neck and certainly at the time brought a tear to my eyes. And every time I hear that piece of music, it comes back to me. Now, how did that happen? It didn't happen by accident. It happened by Yes, I probably did have to provoke and challenge and role model a bit. I had to make a fool of myself and dance and demonstrate this was something that I could do. But a clear part of the teaching and learning process was handing over responsibility for the learning process and showing that I was not the expert. And think of the times that we've sat in classrooms that the teacher actually proves how stupid you are by proving how clever they are, instead of demonstrating that actually learning really comes from ignorance. And freeing people up to say, I could do that. So within this dance, the youngsters were choosing the music. They were building upon a vocabulary that I had taught them and that we developed collectively, and then pulled that together into a performance. And then performed that in front of a dance festival where half the school participated in it and half of them were boys. That's still the greatest achievement that I've ever had in my career. And I talked about it recently, and a couple of kids who are now in their mid-30s came up to me and said, that stuck with me. That meant something to me. So what lessons from that as I've moved on through learning and teaching and into leadership? And I have climbed the greasy pole. And why did I do that? I sometimes do reflect on why I wanted to do that. Basically, it was because of dissatisfaction with what I saw. I've always had a fundamental problem with top-down hierarchical models. Why? Well, probably because I'm a bit of a rebel. I didn't think I needed anybody over my shoulder as a teacher, as a principal teacher, holding me accountable for my performance. Well, not as a dancer, but as a teacher. I didn't need anybody to be looking at the results. I was born and lived above my dad's surgery. My father was a GP in Portobello. For 12 years, I lived above the surgery. Nobody checked what he did. He would be up twice a night to go and look at patients. It was about service and duty. And actually, I think most teachers that I've ever come across are driven by that. And it's connecting with that sense of self and that sense of duty and obligations that they are. And the role of leadership is to allow people to do that job. And that's what I have tried to do, and on many occasions failed miserably, because it's difficult to challenge the perceptions that people have once people are in positions of authority, and often it can get in the way. So as Rory said, I am exploring the notion of leadership, particularly leadership that enables and facilitates innovation to take place. And we need to think much more about what are the leadership behaviours that people manifest and demonstrate that allow people to feel that they can step forwards. And that, I think, is my role as a leader. And I always saw it as that way. It wasn't me, and that's a difference between words. You sometimes, if you listen to chief executives carefully or leaders, the language that they use betrays their approach. They will talk about driving performance. They will talk about being data-led. They will not talk about lifting an organisation. They won't talk about enabling. They won't talk about curiosity. They won't talk about intuition. And they certainly won't talk about forgiveness. So I've, over the last 20 years, been developing a model which I call, actually, the Kianis Index. Kianis is Gaelic for leadership. And it's based upon 7 metaphorical lenses that you can look at your behaviour as an individual now. And I would ask you maybe just to reflect upon yourselves just now as to where are your default lenses when you look at your own behaviour. Because by doing that, you can sometimes recognise that there are lenses that you don't use. So the lenses very quickly are as follows. The sculptor. The sculptor is innovative, creative, has a notion of the future but is not necessarily tied down to it, is comfortable with uncertainty, will use their subjective judgment and has that sense of vision for the end point, but is intuitive. That's the sculptor. The scientist looks at what is the knowledge base around this? What is the data telling me? If I experiment, what is my curiosity driving me to look at? If I test things, what is the evidence telling me? Can I suppress some of my emotional responses to actually interpret that data accurately? So we have the sculptor, we have the scientist, and the next one is the builder. And the builder has a plan, and unlike the sculptor, has a definitive endpoint, knows what they're going to try and do, but in terms of resilience, planning, resources, and budgeting. We've then got the gardener. And the gardener metaphor is really powerful because it's about deferred reward, it's about taking a long-term vision, it's being prepared to be patient, but it's also about nurturing and supporting and recognising that there are different environments. And what works and grows in one environment will not necessarily grow in another. But how often do leaders try and transplant something from one area to another? But particularly it's that notion of the long-term deferred reward. I will plant my tatties in the spring and I won't get them till the autumn. Or I'll plant an oak tree beside an abbey in the Borders, and 500 years' time they'll be able to knock it down and use that oak tree to replace the beams. That's long-term thinking. So from there we go to the conductor. And I think, for me, this is the key role in leadership. It's not about conducting in terms of I am the expert. The role of the conductor is to recognise that everybody in the orchestra is better than you are. And I think that's the key in leadership, recognising that the people round about you are better than you at what they do. My job is to facilitate and enable that and to coordinate that performance. And yes, sometimes I might present some challenge to you, but it's only in terms of trying to raise that high quality performance, because by doing that, we can work in harmony. Now, it really sounds like you can do that collectively, but that's a really powerful element in terms of the role model. But if you move towards too much of the directing and telling people what to do, you lose it. So that's the conductor. And the last one is the villager. And that villager is about the notion of community. It is about the notion that we are all part of the same place. That relationships matter, give and take matters, obligation to our community and service to our community matter. So those are the seven lenses. There's a fantastic book by Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner in economics, who talks about fast and slow thinking. We talk about slow eating. But basically what Kahneman is saying, most of us in our behaviours actually think fast. We do what we've done before. And what Kahneman's talking about, particularly from the world of investment, is we need to slow our thinking down and look at things through different perspectives. So if I give away my default positions, I default to the parent model. Oh, sorry, I missed out the parent model. The last metaphor in there was the notion of the parent, which is about forgiveness, self-sacrifice, support, promoting independence and enabling that to come, but also unconditional positive regard. Sorry, that was the last lens that I had missed out. But that notion, so for myself, parent, villager and sculptor are my defaults. And I need to think when I'm doing my work much more about the builder and the scientist. Although I'm curious about knowledge, I don't always necessarily reflect enough upon the data and what that's telling me. But the key to all of that when you're working with people is an appreciative view of individuals and focusing on people's assets as opposed upon their deficits. And in terms of a role as a director of education, I think the notion of food, if I use a particular example, I went to an event food was being served to us. And I made a pledge at that point I would invite every head teacher in East Lothian to come and have a meal at my house, and I would cook them a meal. And if I talked about the best thing I've ever done as a teacher, the best thing I ever did as a director of education was to do that. Because in groups of five, they came to my house, and I cooked them a meal. Reasonable meal. It was fresh products. And if I meet people now, the thing that they always come back to was that notion of that meal. And why was it? It's because we became people. We did not become roles. We became people that mattered. We talked about our families, our ambitions, our aspirations, and that life became real. And when we took that back into the world of work, tremendous enhancement. And I think there's a real danger in the current society with the pressure on budgets that we become mechanistic and process-driven and system-led and forget about the person and about the people, and that we're not appreciative enough. So I said I'd finish with a reflection on Shetland. I'd never been to Shetland before until 3 weeks ago. I've fallen in love with the place. It's a fantastic place. It is barren. It is cold. It is windy. You would not believe it. The waves smash against the cliffs and rise into the sky about 100 feet. And the women are the stroppiest women I have ever met in my life. And I came home after my first visit. What is it about the women? And I did a bit of research, because I remember the scientific model, I thought I'll go in. And there's some fantastic papers on society in Shetland about the maternal drive. And why was it? Men went to sea. Women looked after the croft and raised the family. I was going to professional meetings and seeing those same women. So if you won't mind, I'll finish with a wee poem that I wrote entitled Shetland Woman. Growing out of the Shetland rock, windswept, soaked through, standing high against the breaking Atlantic surf, as the tide came in and the tide went out, as the seasons fell upon the treeless ground, living scraped from undernourished soil, left alone while men were thrown to the seven seas. Untroubled by adversity, they raised their young, clung to their land through the simmer dim and the black winter day, but a song was in their heart, the soft music of their words, turning hardship to advantage, tempering souls as mothers to an island race. See them now, one generation from the croft, the Shetland rock still running to their core, as their velvet soft voices remaining calm as the wind lifts and the waves break, as the howling wind scars across the land, as the crops rot in the fields, never complaining, or as the Shetland woman once said, never greet for onything, it canna greet for you. And that last phrase means, never cry for anything that cannot cry for you. It's people that matter. Resilience is imbued in those people, but it's always trying to see that positive. And I think that is the lesson for leadership, and it's the lesson, I think, for happiness, regardless of the circumstances that we face. Thank you.